Well, I believe that traditional marriage is a domestic abuse paradigm, and that marriages skew toward that paradigm, toward tradition, unless you and your spouse are doing a superhuman amount of work to correct for the misogyny that's baked into every social system in our culture.
Greetings, hello, and welcome to The Feminist Present, the podcast where we use the gift of feminism to figure out what's going on right now. I'm Laura Good, and it's pretty much me figuring out where feminism is leading us today because Adrian is in Greece, which I'm not shit-talking. Adrian takes zero vacations, and we are stating on the record that The Feminist Present is deeply supportive of Adrian being far away from Wi-Fi right now. And as a result, I got to have the genius Sarah Manguso all to myself in this conversation, and it's probably for the best because Adrian would never have gotten a word in edgewise. Sarah and I are talking about her brilliant novel, Liars, which is coming out on July 23rd of this year. We described this book in detail in this conversation, but this is a book about how heteronuclear marriage traps women artists and drains them of their productivity. It is so engrossing. I didn't even get a chance to tell Sarah that I read this book in one sitting on a plane. I barely looked up. Like, this book had my full attention. Sarah and I talk about so many things, all related to feminism. Surprise. We are really excited to have Sarah here today. We also have some exciting other conversations coming up. So please tune in again. For now, please enjoy this conversation between me, Laura Good, and the author, Sarah Manguso.
Sarah Manguso, is this book like a governmental psyop to implant into my brain specifically? Like, I could not have been a softer target for this book. I just have to narrate a little bit how this conversation got set up. I got the sweetest email from your editor, like directly from your editor. I get a lot of publicist emails. Not often do I get like a heartfelt editorial email being like, "You're going to love this book. Dear Laura Good, you're going to need this book." She was so right. I mean, if Liz Lenz loves a book and Maggie Smith loves a book, chances are I'm going to love the book. So I was so delighted that she reached out. And I guess, like, I have so many questions, but the first one I want to ask is just like, what was your way into this story? Like, was there an image or a sentence or a scene or a conflict that put the key in the lock to this for you?
Yeah. Well, I underwent a high conflict divorce during COVID. Almost solo parenting our young child. You know, anybody who's gone through a prolonged legal process like that knows that you really have to maintain your composure in a lot of really difficult meetings with people you know well and with absolute strangers. And I just really needed an outlet, and I needed to let Jane be as angry as I felt, but could not express in my actual life. And I know that sort of beginning with that and confessing that really gives people an in to say, like, well, you know, women's writing is therapeutic, obviously, because she had a big feeling, and she had to make work in order to express that, you know, process that big feeling. And, but I mean, I think that's true for everything I've ever written. So,
yes.
Yeah.
And everything everyone's ever written, like, I have so much trouble with exactly the stance you just alluded to, because, like, show me the writer that isn't drawing from personal experience. What the fuck else would we possibly have to draw upon? You can do research, but it's all coming from your own motivation, you know?
Yeah, so no, I tend it's true. To think, we're human, after yes. all. Or, you know, one assumes.
Yes.
A fiction writing, you know, a consistent fiction writing friend said to me, you know, we were sort of trying to figure out how to sort of find a way into the conversation about autofiction, how, you know, often women's writing is minimized or categorized as autofiction. And she said, you know what? It's all autofiction, which is exactly what you just said.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, if you're writing with a human being's perspective on events happening to other, you know, human or quasi-human characters, you're going to bring some sort of personalness to the project. And yeah, I try not to use the word autofiction, but I've just used it like 4 times in a row. So off to a great start.
I think that maybe how you feel about the word autofiction is the way I feel about confessional poetry, where I'm just like,
thank you. Yes.
I hate the way this has been delineated, and I am studying it, and I am doing it, and I am all in.
Well, thank you for that. Yeah, I began life as a poet. So
me too.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Wow. Well, yeah, I tend to like prose writers and prose writers who begin life as poets.
Why? Like, I do too, but I want to hear the Sarah Manguso answer.
Yeah. So I want to be careful.
We're not besmirching the novelists. We're being inclusive.
I'm not besmirching, and I don't think I'm really revealing a bias. It just seems that when I find a prose writer who is new to me, more often than not, I find out that they began as a poet. I mean, it's just sort of like, and that's the data.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, I mean, you can draw all kinds of conclusions about, you know, they pay more attention to each word. I don't think that's necessarily true. But I think that I've thought about this a lot, because when I sort of drifted into writing prose after publishing a couple books of poetry, it was like the main question. And mm-hmm. of course, people are probably interested. You know, that's something observable that you can ask a question about. I think for me, it was just sort of a gradual shift from being a short form writer to being a longer form writer. And I was naive enough in my 20s, when I realized I wanted to be a writer, that I couldn't really get more than a page or two out in, you know, a couple of days of work. So I thought, oh, well, that's poetry. You know, if it's that short, it must be a poem, mm-hmm. which in my case was not true. But I mean, I can't count how many prose writers whose work I really, really, really value that either are simultaneously producing poetry or started as strictly poets. And now you too are in this wanted category.
I'm right there. I mean, and I'm thinking again of Maggie Smith, who blurbed your book, who is herself a poet, who wrote that incredible memoir about her divorce. One of the things that struck me about this book about divorce that I loved, I'm also a divorced woman with plenty of anger that I am like pipelining through a legal process. So like, I am relating very much to what you're saying into this book. Like, this book chooses not to retcon just the divorce, but to actually reverse engineer the entire relationship to show the red flags that appeared at the very beginning, which I think is both a really effective literary technique and, like, really true to life in the retrospective view of a relationship. Like, most of us can see the DNA of what went wrong from the very beginning. Can you talk a little bit about like your craft approach to that?
Yes.
How did you make those craft decisions?
Yes, absolutely. So it is true that this is a divorce novel, and that it's sort of being considered alongside some other contemporary books that happen to be about divorce or center divorce, both fiction and nonfiction. And I think of this book as it's more like a book about self-deception. So initially I chose the title Liars to describe the cheating husband and his affair partner. But as I wrote, almost, you know, pretty early on, I realized that the biggest liar is the wife, the protagonist, Jane. And her marriage has to end for her to stop lying about it to other people, but mostly to herself. You bring up this sort of, I love the way you put it, like the sort of the failure that's threaded through the DNA of the entire relationship.
Yeah.
It was really important to me to create a critical mass of details that added up to just, you know, staggering abuse, because I knew how I would be able to do it in all in one fell swoop in one, you know, terrible scene in which, you know, a character does an abuse, and people will be like, oh yeah, that, like that, you know, that,
there's,
that, the, bad per- there's yeah. the bad guy, you know, here's the climax. you know, now I get it. This is like the big, you know, it's like the big change that happens. And then after that, there's the falling action. But I didn't want it to be shaped like that. I wanted it to resemble long marriages that end in divorce, because I mean, if you're living through a long relationship in real time, you're processing a lot of details. And I dare say, if you are the so-called domestic spouse in the arrangement, if there are kids, or you know, if there's a home to be managed, you know, the spouse that's doing all of that stuff is just dealing with a trillion details all the time, and it's just it's an unending cascade. And I needed a way to just produce all of these tiny moments, like the scene where Jane remarks to herself that John has never really thrown anything into the garbage. It's like always sort of like balanced on the very top of the garbage. Mm-hmm. Is that abuse? Mm-hmm. No, that's not abuse. That's just a tiny, tiny, like absolutely insignificant detail next to bigger details like, you know, not coming home or like, you know, hitting her, which is not something that John does to Jane. But I wanted the details to be almost imperceptible as covert abuse in the beginning. And I wanted to sort of, you know, curtail the writer's tendency toward like really hating John until, you know, a critical mass sort of happens. And I think readers get to that critical mass at different spots. You know, I've had some responses to the book that say like, you know, John's a cartoon villain. It's so obvious that he's, you know, an abusive, narcissistic bag of hot air from, you know, page 4. And then other people are like, oh my God, I was so shocked when the big thing happens. I've absolutely loved hearing how this is going down, how it's being perceived, realistic or wholly unrealistic or somewhere in between.
Okay, you're talking, your words are leading a path into exactly the woods that I wanted to enter with you, because this is a book about divorce. That's a really important thematic through line. But it's not only about divorce. It's about what happens to a woman artist in the nuclear family, you know, which is certainly a force that is primarily leveraged by the man, but is not his alone either. I'm thinking of your line on page 240. A nuclear family can destroy a woman artist. I'd always known that, but I'd never suspected how easily I could fall into one anyway. The descriptor easily is doing a lot of work to me there. I don't, it's not easy, but it is cumulative. And that is what's devastating about it to me in both the literary impact and the relational impact. The item balanced on the garbage can is insignificant the first or maybe even the second or third time it happens. But the 10th or 20th or 100th time it happens, it's part of a system of control. It's part of a system of giving a human more work than they could possibly take on and maintain an artistic career at the same time. Like, that is the savage abuse to me, is both the way this John steals Jane's confidence and self-reliance, but really the biggest theft is fucking time. He steals all her time with his foot. Sorry. When you were talking before, I was like, when did I start hating John in this book? Because that's a really interesting question that you raised. And for me personally, and this is inextricably tied to the fact that I've been through a divorce, I've lived a version of this story, it was the moment when he didn't pay her back the $8,000, which I think is maybe 30 pages in. That was the moment where I was like, this man is not trustworthy. He's never going to pay back this money. He is here to take more than he gives. And that, I think, is a testimony to, again, the craft that you affected in that, to drop that foreshadowing detail. I'm going to stop talking, and I want to hear what you think.
Oh, no, I'm really glad that you noticed the financial stuff early on.
Oh, my God. It was giving me, like, physical anxiety in my chest every time numbers came up. Like, yes.
Well, I'm sorry, and thank you. So he says, you know, he just has to save up for a ring. Jane says she doesn't want a fancy ring. He gets more, you know, she gets a bunch more shirts made. Then he asks Jane for more. Yeah, then he asks Jane for money or for more money, having, you know, already taken several thousand dollars from her. And then he asks his mother for money, and then he buys a $200 lamp. And it's just, again, it's an accumulative. I love the way that you say it's cumulative, because yeah. You know, you can't say he bought a $200 lamp, because it's so easy for somebody to say, like, come on, it's just a lamp. Why are you being so crazy about a lamp? But you asked about how, you know, what the accumulation was, you know, ultimately commandeered to show us. And it's really that, well, I believe that traditional marriage is a domestic abuse paradigm, and that marriages skew toward that paradigm, toward tradition, unless you and your spouse are doing a superhuman amount of work to correct for the misogyny that's baked into every social system in our culture. So you said, you were talking about the word easily. Yes, it's like a terrible chute that you can fall down, especially after offspring appear, absent the, benefit of extreme wealth, which would allow a woman to outsource all of the drudgery that is being, you know, piled upon her by the, let's say husband, because I feel like, you know, a husband can be someone of any gender, but this isn't a book about how men suck. It's a book about how husbands suck.
I mean, okay. So I teach feminist literature and we're on a gender studies podcast. So obviously I'm thinking about gender, and I was teaching a class last fall called Feminist Life Writing. And this group was just extraordinary. Like, it was just an unusually wonderful group of students. And we read an abuse memoir called Excavation by Wendy C. Ortiz.
Oh, which I know
completely
that
book. Yes. Oh my God. It's so good. It's so She's good. Such a good writer. It's, I think, actually very comparable to this one in the way it charts the path of abuse and the easily that we're talking about, quote unquote. I paired that book with a self-help book that I like a lot. I'm checking myself on my own queasiness on the term self-help. I'm just going to go with it. The book is called The Gift of Fear. It's by a personal security guy called Gavin DeBecker.
Oh yeah, of course. I'm familiar with the title. It was marketed very aggressively. I haven't read it yet, though.
It sure was. There's definitely like a whole debate we could have about this book and like what's wrong with it and all of that. But I think there are some really valuable principles in it. And I was thinking of them as I was reading this book. Specifically, there's a chapter where DeBecker kind of goes through what he calls survival signals, which are basically how he's naming the red flags that some sort of abuse or dysfunction is coming. And God, Sarah, like the majority of them were in this book. Like, just to give you a few examples, the one that I was thinking about is forced teaming. Like, the abuser says to the abused subject, we've got a lot to do here, we better get going. And all of a sudden they're on a team, right? Like, that's happening all the time here. The really big one that I was thinking of is loan sharking, which basically is just like, I'll read from the book. The predatory criminal generously offers assistance, but is always calculating the debt. So it's basically someone seems to be offering you something, but it's really just a mechanism to keep taking. Like, John is the loan shark in this entire relationship. And like, one of the, you mentioned children in this. I mean, children are such a perfect trap for this kind of labor entrapment, right? Like, could you talk a little bit about how this relationship in the novel changes and in what ways when a child enters the picture?
Oh, yeah. Well, the child happens during a phase when the relationship is really, it's really going John's way in a big way. John has already convinced Jane to move across the country twice. And it's always in a way that seems very reasonable on the surface. So the first move is because John has started a company, and, you know, as every first-time entrepreneurial spouse knows, it can be, very seductive to think like, oh my gosh, this, you know, this business could be the one. This, you know, we might be on Easy Street in 2 years. And John always keeps his financial arguments, extremely concrete when he wants to convince Jane that his way is the way. So there are always spreadsheets. There's a calculator. There are numbers. I think logic. I think he says, like, you know, in 2 years we'll be earning this much, and so on and so forth. And then, you know, like more than 90% of companies, the company fails. And then John decides that, you know, rather than stay where they are, they should go back from LA to New York for Jane to have this baby.
Famously, so, an easy place to raise children. I mean, everybody knows
famously
that.
Famously, easy place to raise children. But remember, like, it's all about building John's career at this point. So he's going to work at a big company now and sort of, you know, do the opposite thing from starting a company of his own. So no sooner do they get back to New York, and Jane is sort of, you know, faced with all of the labor of trying to find a gynecologist, you know, an OBGYN who will take somebody who's, you know, about to have a baby, who is geriatric, who, you know, has all of these other medical limitations that do not make it easy. John is just sort of, you know, feeling his oats, staying out late. You know, by the time the baby arrives, John is grieving his mother, who's died just a few days before. Mm-hmm. And he is
his prescient mother, who we will also be talking about.
Oh yes, Eve. Yeah, Eve is my favorite character in this book.
Interesting.
Yeah, she gets my favorite scene, which we should definitely talk about. But yeah, I mean, John is just AWOL in all of the familiar het norm ways that a father is just not available, not accountable, and who willfully and aggressively ignores all of the work that Jane is doing with this newborn. And then at some point he says, you know, your life is so much easier than my life right now because my mom's dead and I don't like my job. And this is when Jane is postpartum. You know, she's having all of these psychiatric, very typical, very normal, within normal limits, postpartum depression and anxiety. And this is sort of like act two of the book. I think that is when Jane really starts to think that she is absolutely stuck, you know, with the newborn in a new city, without a job, you know, completely dependent on John to sort of do some of the heavy lifting of just keeping them solvent and sane. And he is just not even up to that.
I guess what I was just thinking is, like, except in the cases of romances where an accidental pregnancy happens very early on and surprisingly, children are almost always act two of the romance story, right?
In this kind of paradigm. So apt. Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, you have to build the foundation of act one to want to proceed to the act two, again, unless a surprise or accident happens, which it does all the time. And the way you structured this novel as a pattern of increasing entrapment really supports that, like, children are the act two snare. Because this is what keeps so many women trapped,
right?
Oh,
absolutely. Yes.
The belief that divorce, the material and psychological entrapments happen for women around children. The belief that divorce is incurably traumatizing to children keeps so many women trapped. Economic dependence on the man keeps so many women dependent and trapped. Like, just, I don't know. One of the most interesting things that I took from Liz Lenz's book, which we've also mentioned, is that divorced mothers, like, in a way that is substantiated by research, have more time to themselves than married mothers. Like, man, does liars demonstrate that, right?
It's uncanny. And I should say, I'm going to just briefly lift the veil and say that me, Sarah Manguso, in the first 3 years after my divorce, I wrote 3 books. Before that, it took me 5 years to write 1 book. So that's not coincidental.
I just have to tell you, like, I don't want this to sound like one-upping. It's just, like, agreeing with you so strongly. In the 6 months after I left my marriage, I finished 4 books that had been trying to kill me for 5 years.
Oh, that's so beautiful. Wow.
It was so beautiful.
I would love to collect so much more of this data, and I'm sure there is so much of it.
It was not
I'm so happy
subtle,
for you.
Sarah. It was not subtle. Like, Wow. Exactly. Wow. Yeah.
I can't wait to read them.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I mean, I just, my relationship with my kids has been so much better since my divorce.
Mine too.
And I want to say that on the record because I know how many scared women there are out there.
Oh, there's so much messaging around the fact that it's harder to be a single mom than it is to be married.
And it's a lie.
I'm here to say that it is so much easier to be a single parent than to be married to a worse than useless man. A man who is trying to sabotage, you know, everything that benefits the family, anything that benefits anything in the structure except for him. And some of this may be covert, some of it may be automatic or just learned and not intentional, but it can't all be unintentional.
No, it can't. It's funny, as you're talking, I'm like, you know, honestly, even like having devoted the amount of thought to this that I have and hating John as much as I do, I still don't believe that every one of his actions in this story was intentional or was like intended to create abuse. I think that men go through the same gender brainwashing that women do, and that leads them to center themselves in really destructive ways. We have skipped over something that I think is really crucial to mention in this discussion, which is like the role of the liberal creative man. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, I think it's very significant to this story that both John and Jane start out as artists. And John makes a pivot that he claims is intentional, but like the book reveals is probably also due to his lack of talent or drive. So much of the sabotage that you were naming seems born out of jealousy, right? Yeah. Seems born out of the fact that he cannot stand for her to succeed when he didn't. And I think that that's also a really important force to talk about, that this jealousy is so common in relationships, and particularly in relationships where people are in the same field or neighboring fields. And I also think that there's this inclination in American discourse to like throw out all the conservative men, but like the liberal men must be okay. And like the liberal men are not okay, Sarah. Like, can you talk about that in this frame?
I am so happy to talk about that. And I read Liz's book. I loved it. And I think one important point of comparison is that Liz is sort of extra brainwashed. You know, she was set back by having come up in a very, very conservative community where mm-hmm. she was really heavily groomed to become a young wife, a young mother, and a subservient wife.
She and I grew up 5 miles from each other, by the way. Liz
Lenz
and
I did. Love this detail. That is so beautiful.
Oh, yeah. We could have been friends in high school, but weren't. Yes, go on.
Now, is this in Iowa or SoDek?
She went to high school and college in Minnesota and now lives in Iowa, but we grew up very close to each other in Minnesota.
Oh, wonderful. Okay. Right. So you were saying that, yes, of course, it's easy to write off conservative men because they're very overt about the belief that women are side characters in their heroic narratives about, you know, whatever they want to be, like a great artist or a politician or just like a family man, a guy that doesn't really have to do anything, but really enjoys being in a family because everything is done for him by, you know, children are there to love him. The wife is there to help the children love him. So anyway, so conservative men, sure. But women of my generation, liberal women of my generation, I'm 50, were sold a bill of goods for a new kind of progressive heterosexual partnership that for most of us never materialized.
Did not materialize, yes.
No, it did not. We were told like second wave feminism finished the job.
We're good.
Because, you know, women were told that, you know, we could have everything, we could be everything. And you know, in the sort of to use your rubric here, which I love, the first act of Jane and John's relationship, they're both functioning as men, right? Mm-hmm. So they are the hero of their own stories. They are going to be great artists.
She says she's a workaholic and he says, oh, thank God. Like that moment really stuck with me. Yeah.
That was a moment of great and enveloping safety for Jane. Mm-hmm. She really felt that they would absolutely be you know, each as powerful as the other in this partnership.
They could be art monsters together in her vision. Yes.
Exactly. Yes. They could pursue what they wanted to pursue. And then, of course, you know, a child comes and lo and behold, they're not partners anymore. She is the great man's wife. There's another passage where Jane, rather late in the game, I would say act three, after mm-hmm. after the big thing happens, after John leaves, Jane says that she finally realized that she had rewritten John's secret narrative of his life, in which he was the great artist, the hero, and that he hated her for it. He resented her for it. And as you were saying, you know, this all of his acts of sabotage might not have been intentional, mm-hmm. but some of them were. And so one thing that I just want to quickly, one scene that I just want to quickly describe that came up earlier, when Jane is heavily pregnant yes. with the child,
yes,
she and John are planning to take a short trip from New York to London because one of her books is nominated for a prize, and it's potentially a lot of money.
It's a big deal prize. Like, you can tell even in a novelistic setting that this is a really big fucking deal. Yeah, my chest is getting tight again. Please keep talking.
Oh, yeah. Please. Yes, breathe it out if you can. And Jane, you know, at this point is exhausted. It's late in the pregnancy. She goes to bed early. And then the buzzer rings and she looks at the clock and it's like almost 3 a.m. And a stranger's voice says, "Does John Bridges live here?" And she goes down to see that John has almost drunk himself to death. He has shattered his nose. He is vomiting and bleeding all over the entryway to this new apartment that they just signed a lease for. And Jane goes into what the writer Tracy Shorn, a.k.a. Chump Lady, calls the chaos janitor part of her personality. She runs mm-hmm. up. She gets towels. She's, you know, waddling down the stairs with this giant belly. She cleans up the mess. And John is just sort of standing there. And he's like gurgling something. And when she draws near to hear what it is, she hears that he's saying, "You're welcome." And it's supposed to be this funny, light-hearted, you know, writing off of this whole silly little moment. So she calls the paramedics. They go to the hospital. The paramedics are looking at Jane and almost shaking their head. Like, you know, they can smell the tequila in the vomit. And they're thinking, you know, look at this dumb idiot, this woman who chooses to have a baby with this man. Needless to say, they don't go to London. And then everybody, I say everybody, but really the John's mother and Jane's mother both say, "Yeah, it's too bad he didn't get to go to London." And Jane really feel it's a real mind fuck for her because she's wondering, like, why, if this isn't such a big deal, if nobody's really reacting to this, you know, if this is just a funny story about daddy, why do I feel like I'm being torn apart?
It's so diabolical, like his willingness to damage himself to create yes. more work for her.
Yes. Well, it's also that's what addicts do. That's yes. what an alcoholic does.
Absolutely. Yeah. The addictive behavior was obviously radiating into the drinking, and it also seemed to be really radiating into the money. You know, the sort of, I mean, what is addict brain? Never enough. Never enough. Never enough. Right. And yes. like. I'm pausing and breathing because I was married to a startup founder, and a lot of what you're describing is just like deeply familiar to me. You were talking a minute ago about my favorite part of the book, which is when Jane wrests back control of the story and starts rewriting what really happened. Like, that to me was such an important reclamation of narrative power that this book would not have been complete without. I'm looking on page 243. "So I wasn't mourning an experience of being that wife. I was mourning a romantic image of her walking with her beloved and adoring husband who had never existed."
Yes.
That is the trap. Yeah. That image keeps so many women true. Trapped. It's so important to name the walking out of that. I was just so grateful that you did, you know?
Yes. I'm so grateful that you brought it up, because if you look at the data, and I think a lot of this is in Liz Lenz's book, mm-hmm. You know, you think of the okay, so part of the cultural messaging about why long marriages are good is because when you get sick and old, your spouse will take care of you. Statistically, the woman will take care of the man something like 90% of the time. If the woman gets sick, the man leaves almost 100% of the time. Okay, my statistics are not accurate. They're slightly emotionally.
These are poet statistics. Yes.
Please don't. I'm not a social scientist. Once you look at the numbers, it's harder to cling to that story because it's simply not enacted in the culture. It was also important to me, as Jane is wresting back control over the story, she is undergoing a huge amount of trauma. And mm-hmm. it was crucial to me to represent the way that trauma impedes a person's ability to remember stuff.
Yes.
She has to keep repeating the story, sort of, you know, she tries to make
these. She's like assembling the fragments as she collects them. Yeah.
And she wants this very compact version of it so she can remind herself of it. She can't integrate all the details until the trauma, the terror has passed. Neuropsychiatrists say, look, memories form in safety. You can't be flooded with adrenaline and lay down long-term memory.
Yes.
I know that from experience. And so I had to represent that in the book in the same way that it affected me. I just couldn't. I would try to tell the story of what happened to, you know, somebody I hadn't been in touch with in a while and ask me how I was doing, how COVID was going. And it was fascinating to me that I could come up with like three details for one person. And then for another person, I would forget like the most important part. And
it was
just mind bending. And it was interesting from a literary point of view, if terrifying from a basic mental health point of view.
Well, that's what I'm noting, is it's so effective in both a literary and psychological sense. Like, it is essential to the completion of the cycle in both a literary and psychological sense. I mean, when you say a few pages after the passage we were just talking about, the rage had left my body and the rest of the feelings were finding their way back in. Like, that is a really crucial and hard to describe part of healing, is like, okay, the harm has stopped, so my nervous system can go out of crisis mode. And that means that a lot of other complex feelings that I've been suppressing for years are going to like enter the chat. That's a shit show at the fuck buffet is what I call that clinically, I think.
Yeah, that is a clinical term. That it's a useful term.
Poets. Yes, totally.
Yeah. You know, you can't feel grief. You can't feel anything really until you aren't raging anymore.
Totally. And until you and your child are safe, you know, like you say, memories are formed in safety.
Can we talk about mental health for a second?
The answer is yes. Absolutely.
I'm so glad.
Yes.
I'm so glad. Unstable is a word that domestic abusers use to describe their victims. They use that word to distract
people.
Do you
need to go to the hospital real quick? Are you sure you're okay? Do we need to hospitalize you?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I should frame this. The marketing department of my publisher said, like, remember, just bring, every time you're making a point, bring up a scene. And I have not done that. So I'm going to bring up a scene.
You have
this,
done
this
that.
Really,
I disagree. Go
okay,
on.
Thank you. Yes. Well, I could be doing better with that. The scene that you just alluded to is the scene during which John ambushes Jane while she's just in the middle of this like very relaxed moment watching a video on her computer. And he says, how many more minutes do you have in that video? And she said, I don't know, you know, it's like 25 more minutes. Why do you want to watch something together? And he said, no, we have to talk. And then she said, okay, what do you want to talk about? And he said, I want a divorce. And it's calculated to come completely out of nowhere. And it was calculated to destabilize her maximally. And, you know, she takes a breath and says, no, like, aren't we supposed to go to couples therapy before making a decision like that together? Like, why don't we just do that? And he said, no, we're not going to therapy. You're the one that's sick and therapy has not helped you. You are still as crazy as you've always been. And that is the beginning of Jane's, I mean, I guess you could call it a trauma response. She becomes that unstable person that he's dying for her to be. And he then says, do you want me to call an ambulance? Do you want to go to a psych ward? And it's at that moment that Jane realizes she's dealing with her enemy here. This isn't just like two people breaking up. This is an abuse paradigm.
And thank God, what a testimony to Jane's brilliance that she can recognize that.
She recognizes it, but her body is not letting her behave like the sane person she knows she is. The crazy, crazy in quotes, woman and the calm man is an abuse paradigm that is still so easily misread. People still seem to be buying the story that women just go crazy out of nowhere and their long-suffering husbands just don't know where it came from. They're just so crazy.
These poor sweet men. Yes. Yeah.
And, you know, Jane finds herself in divorce mediation on Zoom because it's COVID. And John just sits there calmly lying. I think it was Sarah Kendzior who initially called Mike Pence a calm liar and that was what was so terrifying about him. John is a calm liar.
Yes. Yes.
He's fucking great at it. And Jane cannot, in this traumatized state, keep from reacting to it. She is voluble. She is crying. She is raging and yelling. And she is, you know, it's called the second wound in abuse studies. Like when people don't believe the truth, when people say like, oh no, this isn't abuse. Like you're obviously crazy and John is obviously sane. You know, that's the second wound. Because
I've never heard that term. That's so poignant.
Oh yeah. The mediator is just like, well, yeah, I don't get this. John's calm. Like what's the problem here? And Jane realizes that people don't, I hope I got that right. People don't see it. Gabby Petito. I mean, I know she's like a, you know, blonde woman in peril thing. You know, like there are many. This is a highly problematic example of anything. But the way that the cop, you know, it was reported that the cop showed up to a domestic, saw a crazy woman and a calm man, and thought, oh, okay, the woman is obviously the aggressor. You know, that shit. Of course, when she was tragically fucking murdered by the calm guy.
Who could have seen that coming? I mean, what a shock.
Yeah, who could have seen that coming? But on the other hand, I feel like that, maybe I'm just too much of an optimist here, but I feel like that was widely enough reported in sort of mainstream culture and media that people might
some dots.
start to get it. Or it might just be that I've been thinking about this for the past 3.5 years nonstop.
I'm thinking about another word you used that I think is related to this, and I'm a verbal processor, so we're just going to travel the path to figure out how.
Great, I am too.
Drag. You use the word drag to apply to heteronuclear marriage, and God, did I relate to that. I mean, I have been an out queer person since college and then started dating a guy who became my husband. And I remember at the beginning just being like, well, this is cute. You know, it's cute for me to put on a little dress and like make dinner. You know, what a fun role to play. What a fun guest star to step into, kind of.
I know. It's perfectly safe. It's just a game that I'm playing.
Women's studies minor. I mean, this is a game, you know?
Oh, yeah. I didn't take my husband's name. I'm not a wife. I'm a partner.
You're coming in with the psyop again, Sarah Manguso, like right into my brain. But the drag is part of the pretense. And to me, this divorce happens when Jane decides to stop pretending. And that's so important to me. Like the implications of her stopping pretending are her deciding that this is all unacceptable. And it was unacceptable from the beginning. And so like down that discursive line of thinking, like this kind, I'm obviously not condemning drag as drag queens practice it. We are explicitly pro drag queen on this podcast, of course.
Correct.
But drag within this literary frame is part of the lie that she first swallows and later has to reject. How does that sit with you, right?
Yes, that's great. Yeah, that's absolutely right. And it's so much like what we were talking about earlier about the, you know, the liberal guy who is, you know, pays lip service to all kinds of feminist ideas, most of all that marriage is a partnership. It's not man and wife, it's husband and wife now. And that means they're equal. what's so sad about it is that Jane feels internally that, you know, if she feels like a partner and she feels convinced by all of the messaging that she's heard that, you know, women can do anything now, they can get a graduate degree, they can open a bank account, they can have an abortion. Oh, wait, no, not anymore. But she thinks that the drag show is not dangerous because
if you're choosing it, how can it be dangerous?
If you're choosing it, how can it be dangerous? And also, if she knows on the inside that it's just drag, it doesn't mean that she's going to be forced into this role as a great man's wife. For John, it's not a drag show. It's what he wanted all along.
Yeah. And one of the most relatable and sinister parts of how this ruse is perpetuated is how many other women are enlisted in convincing Jane that this is not drag. This is a happy life, right? So I think that brings us to the doorstep of we have to talk about your favorite character, Eve.
Oh,
who
I'm
is Eve?
So glad.
What does she do?
Yeah. Eve is John's mother. Eve is John's mother, and she is she seems on the surface to be absolutely, the doting mother of, the very special boy.
She's like the Madonna archetype, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Like
she's there to nurture. She's there to nurture and support, and she loves that they're getting married. And she just comes across as this fairly compliant anti-feminist woman of an older generation that Jane very easily writes off because she thinks, I'm completely different from this woman.
Yeah, she didn't have choices.
Exactly, right. I had all the choices. I went to graduate school. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be a great artist, et cetera, and so on. And then there's a scene. Eve gets sick. Eve has cancer. And John and Jane are visiting with Eve and Eve's husband, who is John's stepfather. And, if there aren't deep conversations are not really happening, but then Eve goes into her room and she hooks up her oxygen. She's taking a moment. And then she calls Jane in to talk, woman to woman. And Jane does not know that this is the last time she's going to see Eve. She doesn't know that this is Eve's deathbed confession. Eve tells Jane that when she was young, when she was in college, her parents offered her a trip to Europe if she didn't marry John's father. And then she puts a blue fennel lollipop into her mouth and closes her eyes and it's done. And Jane doesn't understand why she's chosen this, this stray little piece of her life story to share at this moment and just to Jane. She doesn't get it. She thinks maybe it's like maybe she was over medicated. I don't know. She just wanted to share something.
Well, and there's another thing that happens in this scene that feels so quick and revealing, which is the presence of the stepdad indicates that the father is no longer married to the mother. So clearly there was a divorce somewhere along the way.
Yes, you're absolutely right about that. Yeah. Crucial detail. And Jane tells John, your mom just told me this really crazy story. And John said, wow, I've never heard that. She never told me that. And they kind of laugh and, it just kind of folds into the whirlwind of all of the things that are happening from day to day. There's pregnancy, a death is coming, there's travel. I mean, this isn't even the main event of that day for Jane. But after John leaves, Jane, much, much later in the book, Jane returns to this scene and sort of broods on it, and finally she gets it. Eve knew that Jane was married to a bad guy, that her son was a bad guy. She couldn't bear to say that directly to Jane. I mean, you can't say that to a pregnant woman. You can't say, this guy, this kid that I had.
Nor can a mother say that about her son. Yeah.
A mother can't say that about her son, and she can't say it about the person's husband who's about to have a baby. But she has to tell Jane before she dies. And so she tells it as a kind of fable, as a kind of riddle that Jane figures out, you know, of course, much too late to save herself from years of torture, having stayed with John. But she really gets it. And it's like a little message smuggled out of the madhouse from...
It's a Tiresias moment, kind of. Like, it is a bit oracular, like the dying.
It is absolutely oracular, but it doesn't really. Well, how did you read it? Did you get the moral of the story as Eve was telling it, or only later?
That's such a good question, and I can only answer it autobiographically.
Oh, great!
My parents-in-law own a carnival.
Okay, that's not nightmarish.
We could just stop there. Yeah. Very early on, when I was dating the man who became my husband, I think this might have been like the second time I had ever met his family, I witnessed the people who would become my parents-in-law have a terrible fight. I won't repeat details, but it was a real fight. Afterwards, I found myself alone in the room with the woman who would become my mother-in-law, and in a poignant voice that I couldn't understand at the time because I was only 22, she said, "I don't know, Laura, just marry the right man. That's all I'm telling you."
Oh, actual
so
chills.
That was, I couldn't, yeah. That's how I felt reading your book, Sarah. So when I got to that moment, I couldn't help but view it through that lens. And I know how my story turns out. So yes, I do think I took that as a clue of foreshadowing, but I can't imagine that I would have been able to take that clue had I not had my own version of that moment. But because I have my own version, it's very familiar to me, the whisper network that women try to issue each other without saying too much. Oh. You know?
Wow, that is devastating. Yeah. Well, you've gotten at another piece of cultural messaging that it might be worth talking about a bit, which is that the burden is on a woman to choose a good man. And that all marital problems are a result of a woman not choosing a good man. I mean, I love to torture myself, apparently. And so when I read the comments on the New York Times pages.
You say you do not,
Sarah. Of course
Sarah.
I do. Yeah, I read them because I want to know. I want to know what, like, how, like, you know, old.
A bit of a masochist.
But, you probably a gender studies person at the Clayman Institute would not be surprised, but I think others would be surprised to hear just how frequently that excuse wells up for virtually any kind of domestic abuse that a man can inflict on a woman. Well, she picked the wrong guy, obviously. She picked, he probably, like, actual comments. He probably had a neck tattoo. So she was obviously stupid.
Right. And never mind the crushing cultural pressure to pair off as soon as possible, and you're defective if you don't. Then that's a whole nother layer.
Exactly. Yes. And a lesson that I learned too late is that a ton of apparently progressive men absolutely love patriarchy.
Well, it benefits them so much. Yes.
Yeah. 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 There's an SNL skit that maybe you've seen. I think it's Woman in a Bar, I think is the name of it. And, a woman goes into a bar, she's like wearing, a Kamala t-shirt, and she sits next to a gross guy who hits on her. And then another guy sort of swoops in to save her. And he's like, God, yeah. The future is female. I don't know. He maybe puts a pussy hat on his head. I'm absolutely murdering the details of this wonderful skit. But he, you know, after they exchange maybe like, you know, three remarks back and forth, he's like, so, you know, do I get to fuck you now? Or like, you know, and she's like, ew, no. He's like, what, like, you know, you're not even gonna let me nut. It just, it so beautifully dramatizes the, like, what happens when the mask falls and you're like, oh shit, you know, all of this talk about a drag show, you know, you're like in drag
totally.
As a feminist in order to abuse me later more effectively.
Yep. At least then she doesn't know where she stands from the beginning, so it's just a little more destabilizing.
Exactly. Yeah, if he doesn't have a neck tattoo, how will I know?
Okay, so I have sometimes commented on the emotional terrorism of audience Q&As, particularly for women writers. This is not a memoir. I do think the memoirists have it really bad in the Q&A department.
Agreed.
On the record, Sarah Manguso, preserved for eternity, what are the questions you absolutely will not answer in a Q&A?
Oh my gosh. Well, the thing is, like,
are there questions
that
you will not
answer? Okay, this is my ninth book. I've done a lot of, I mean, not to boast, but you know, they accumulate. Yeah. Like, I've done a lot of Q&As in my life, and I find that there's always something useful to say, no matter how misguided the question is, or you know.
Oh, that's so mature and experienced. Okay,
no,
keep talking.
It's really not. I think it would be much cooler to just sort of glare. I've seen writers writers who I really admire for their writing and for the way that they make their way in the world. You know, they're just too, they're haughty queens. Like, they don't need to respond to questions like that. But I'm sort of, you know, I'm a recovering good student. So, I don't like do the assignments per se, but like, yeah, I have the gloss of, here it comes. I went to Harvard, but, you know, it trains you, it trains you to, just like always skew toward genteel politeness when faced with, you know, an unreasonable question. I don't know the kinds of questions that I can even anticipate. Well, of course, you know, there's the one like, is this all true? To which I'll say, you know, there are certainly some core experiences that I share with Jane. I am divorced. I had a high conflict divorce. You know, we opened and I just closed that. And, you know, my son knows, he was there for it. I guess I'll say that, you know, the reason that I'm not going to get into the details of my marriage and my divorce is that I don't want to burden my son with knowing anything more than what he already knows.
Yeah.
He's 12. He was 8 when his dad left, and he's 12 now, and he's not at a point where he has any interest at all in reading mom's books, and that's great.
Fantastic.
That's fine.
Yes.
That's good. You know, there are creative projects that he and I work on together. You know, he and I did sort of collaborate on a book that's coming out next year, so I've just completely contradicted myself, but it's a book that's going to be illustrated by the genius Liana Fink, who's a New Yorker cartoonist among many other things. I will not disclose, you know, which, if any, details in the book are drawn from my life. So many of my friends have lived through or are still living through marriages to putatively feminist men. So there was no shortage of details for me to borrow and, you know, elaborate on and embroider and invent, just given the sheer amount of data that I had.
God, yes. I've been calling the classic pandemic divorce is what I've been calling it. And there's just a number in my friend circle as well. Yes.
Yeah. So would you say that a pandemic divorce involves like a mask falling that was able to stay up only because, you know, there were secrets that were easily kept when you weren't on top of each other 24 hours a day?
I think that is an incredibly astute and accurate description, but different details. The war being concealed. Like, yes, a mask fell.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, things were revealed in condensed time spent together. Like, the absence of distractions revealed a lot. Yes. And I do think that the pandemic entailed kind of an essential mask falling for almost all of us, except those of us who like strenuously resisted it. You know, like I can't, there's yes. been so many people who have gone through transformative experiences, divorce, hardly the only one, you know?
Yeah. Well, let's also shout out to Jessica Calarco.
Oh my
Jessica
God.
Jessica Calarco, right? Yeah. So she, I believe, is the one who coined the phrase, which is now rampant, happily everywhere. Women are America's social safety net. And at no point in my life so far has this ever been more just absolutely uncontradictable and pervasive and everywhere.
Yep.
Yeah. So that happened.
Yep.
And I'm sure that had, you know, no small role in the, you know, breakage of lots
totally.
Of really bad relationships, really bad for women.
We interviewed Jess Calarco on this podcast, so I'm just going to shout out her book, Holding It Together. And the quote was, most countries have social safety nets. America has women, which I think is even
thank
more
you, Jessica.
Devastating. Thank you, Jessica Calarco.
Yeah, thank you yes. so much for that. That really helped crystallize a lot of the stray thoughts that I was having
for
about Dan
too.
And John and how.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Oh my God. Okay. I think I have to be, I could talk to you about this book for 4 more hours, but I think I have to be respectful of your time. Do you
I'm
have...
really enjoying it. So we can go a little longer if you want.
Well, do you have any upcoming book tour things that you want to plug on the airwaves?
Sure. Yes. I have readings coming up in LA, New York, and San Francisco.
Where in San Francisco?
But
dates and
they're
locations.
Not, they're at the end of July.
Amazing.
And they are as follows. Monday, July 22nd, Skylight Books in LA. Tuesday, July 23rd, launch day, Diesel in LA. And Wednesday, July 24th, at Booksmith with Moira Donegan. Yeah, with the great Moira Donegan.
The Moira Donegan.
Your colleague.
Yes,
your colleague.
Absolutely.
Your claimant. Yeah, so did I say Booksmith?
You did. July 24th at Booksmith with Moira Donegan and Sarah Manguso is an unmissable destination for listeners.
And then finally, the following week, I will be in New York with none other than Liz Lenz at McNally Jackson on August 1st.
Amazing.
I also want to quickly my conversation partners for the two LA events are two other geniuses, Miriam Gerba and Wednesday Martin.
Oh my God. I love Miriam Gerba's work so much. That's fucking great.
I do too. Yeah.
Oh, no, she's so smart.
Huge, huge celestial mass in the firmament of my reading life.
I love that description. Do you have, like, my last question is, this is a question I get from students sometimes. Like, what advice do you have for writers who are writing this kind of emotionally demanding work? Like, how did you take care of yourself as you were doing this?
Yeah, this is a good question. I tend to teach nonfiction more than I do fiction.
Mm-hmm.
So I am frequently working with people who are writing about the, you know, the most terrible thing that ever happened to them. And the advice that I always give is something that helped me when I was writing memoirs some years ago. And it's just that you're not going to, you know, you probably will not be able to articulate everything at the degree of closeness that you would like. And so it's okay to leave some room, leave a little silence to stand in for something that you can't say. And if you do it well, people will read your work and they will notice the silence and they will interpret the silence. And more often than not, they will understand what can't be said, what's just not there. This has happened to me. This,
that
you know, the first time this happened.
Such good advice, dude.
Well,
oh my God.
It comes out only because of a remark that the brilliant writer Deb Olin Unferth made when she read one of my books and said, it happens, you know, it seems to be about such and such. It seems to be about illness. This is my book, The Two Kinds of Decay, which is about chronic illness. It seems to be about illness. But what's really crazy is that there's this vast silence where your parents should be. And I realized that, oh my God, yes. And so it was many years before I was able to write about my childhood and about Massachusetts.
Mm.
And that eventually came out in fiction.
Mm-hmm.
But she was right. There was a lot of stuff about Massachusetts that I simply could not include in that book because it was too, it just, it was its own book. And so that's kind of how I learned that. It was through that experience and other experiences that readers will tell you that it's there, even if it's not there.
Let the silence speak. Mm-hmm. Ugh, that is so beautiful. I would like to pause there. The book is Liars. The author is Sarah Manguso. Sarah, thank you so much for talking to me. This was like pure delight.
I absolutely loved it. Thank you, Laura.
The Feminist Present is a production of the Michelle R. Clayman Institute for Gender Research. The co-hosts are Adrian Daub and Laura Good. This podcast is produced by Ana de Almeida Almiral. We are especially grateful to our feminist colleagues, Allison Bell Crossley, Jennifer Portillo, Cynthia Newberry, Leah Gottlieb, Bethany J. Nichols, Jessica Lopez, Susan Krieger, Argavon Salas, and Moira Donegan.